Someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and I'm here with my co-host,
David Gibson. Hi, Anna.
How's it going?
It is going great. Welcome to 2021.
I'm glad to be here. We did it. We made it.
Yes, it's 2021. Like we were talking about before the, we started recording. I don't know how much different it will be, but it does have a different number at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're really excited to give you the final installment. This one's going to be a little bit longer. But this is going to be the final installment of our interview series with Hal Bell.
And something I'm going to want to kind of point out or draw attention to is if you are listening to this one, as Anna pointed out, it's a little bit longer podcast. But if you are listening to this at 42 minutes and 42 seconds, I believe, of this podcast, Hal Bell gets into a story that I think really encapsulates who Hal is. It's a wonderful story that has to do with peanut butter cookies. And here's that interview with Hal. I know you've spent a lot of interview time and things like that, talking about Oak Ridge. Can you just talk a little bit about your time there, just kind of for context on how you made some of these connections, I guess?
Well, okay. As I said, Oak Ridge had three major plants and also the Manhattan Project headquarters. Probably, I'm torn off the top of my head now, probably a total of about 70,000 people altogether.
Okay.
Of which about half lived on the base or on the project. And the rest commuted in from around the areas. A year before I got there, it was all farmland. When I got there, there was enough probably housing for 30, 40,000 people.
Wow.
Streets, sewers, sidewalks in one place. The three plants all being built and pretty close to being finished. One of which was the largest building in the United States.
Man.
The K-25 building.
Yeah.
It was a U-shaped building and a continuous flow process. So if you straightened it out, it was over a mile long.
Wow.
It was like 50 feet high and like a couple hundred feet across. The steam plant there was the biggest one that built in the United States. They had a hospital and everything you think of. But, and the military guys had kind of special privileges. We weren't truly military.
Okay.
We wore uniforms. We got military pay. We couldn't get promoted until we had been on the project for a year.
Okay.
So you were a buck private. And I was a buck private, and I had nominally, not officially, but actually, my boss was a civilian, his boss was a civilian, and I had reporting through me and to me at different times, half and half civilians and military.
Okay.
Rank didn't mean a thing. Once you got your first stripe, two and a half, 3 months, if you didn't get caught screwing up, you got another stripe.
Okay.
We all had Class A passes, they called it, which meant we could be away for up to 3 days just by signing out.
Okay.
We got paid by check. We had no military duties. except the guys that lived in the barracks area, because I had to clean up right. and all that stuff. Those of us who were married didn't have to live in the barracks area.
Okay.
However, being a military base, the housing, of course, was based upon rank. The quality of the house, the size of the house, the location of the house okay. was based upon rank. We who were military and couldn't leave, couldn't get housing. We had to rent rooms with people who had government housing and usually paid them about as much as they paid the government. We lived in, well, after I'd been there a couple of months, it was pretty obvious that I was not eligible for overseas duty or anything else. You were there, and you were there.
Right.
So I checked with the school system. My wife, who I was married to now, was working in the Long Beach school system as the art teacher for the high school. And I figured, well, let's find out. So I talked to the school system. Do you need an art teacher?
Yeah,
right now.
Yes, please.
So I told her what to do and who to write to, and they offered her a job like that. Long Beach released her from the contract,
mm-hmm.
and she came out there. Now, she expected that she was going to be in a little red schoolhouse
right.
at a Tennessee crossroads. And here's this city with something like 10 elementary schools.
Wow.
And about 3,000 kids in high school.
Man.
And she ended up, by the time we left there, which was about a year and a half, 2 years after she arrived, being the head art teacher of the whole thing.
That is neat.
And it was the best teaching job she ever had. Anything she wanted, they got. Our teacher, her art room was twice as big as anything she ever had anywhere else, and it was adjacent to the music room, so that they were able to coordinate all
their programs
activities.
And things. Oh, that's cool.
Very well done.
Yeah.
In fact, we actually rented a house from one of her teacher friends who went home for a summer vacation. She could get a house. Reggie couldn't. I couldn't.
Okay.
We had to take care of her chickens. We had to take care of our cats.
Yeah.
And we had to pay our rent.
Yeah.
But we had this big house at least for 3 months.
Right.
About 6 months before we left, after the war was officially over, the Army found out that it had some of these little plywood shacks, victory cottages,
okay.
available that had been made for the low-grade construction workers and
right.
and the blacks. Blacks were segregated. And if the blacks weren't married, they were segregated in different areas with fences and everything.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Which we might touch on that in a little bit if that's okay, because that is kind of
But anyways, they found that they had about 10 of them on Raccoon Avenue.
Okay.
That were not being used. And they were about 25 feet on a side, divided in half to two apartments. And each apartment had a sort of a living room and then a kind of a bedroom.
Yeah.
And a tiny little shower type of thing. And in the living room, which was also the kitchen, there was a converted coal stove, cast iron coal
okay.
stove, converted to kerosene. And they'd bring kerosene to a 50-gallon drum up in the road, and you'd go out a gallon at a time, bring it back.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to cook, that stove also heated the apartment.
Everything.
So summer in Tennessee, if you wanted to cook or you wanted hot water, you heated the apartment.
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
But it was ours. It was the first thing we had that was ours.
Oh, that
was
neat.
Great.
Yeah.
And some very good friends of ours that we met, who got married at Ohio State, had the next one And
he
was with me in the lab, and also went to Boeing with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So a long-term friendship.
Yeah. And he ended up being the facilities manager at Rocky Flats.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So anyways, that was kind of fun. So we had these little victory cottages.
Yeah.
And finally had gotten our own things. But you had a supermarket.
Okay.
It wasn't much, but it was a supermarket. We had a sort of a PX in the barracks area that had a bar for beer. And,
yeah.
And you could buy some things that were a little hard to get otherwise.
Right.
Let's see.
See, I guess my mental image of it was always smaller, you know, not quite as
huge.
Oh, it was huge. Yeah.
In fact, you check with on the archives.
Yeah.
That's a huge map I brought in.
I'm going to have to look at that because that's neat. Yeah, because, you know, like I say, when I picture it, you know, I don't picture this little boom town.
Yeah. And there were the plywood shacks, and then there were what they call semesto, which was sort of a hard asbestos thing within wooden frames, and they had coal stoves, so they used to have to shovel coal.
Man.
Now, we were all engineers, you see, so we did a lot of calculating, and we figured out that those of us who had cars, and gasoline was rationed.
Oh, okay.
So we could put about a third of kerosene in our gas tanks, and they'd work. And also, that kerosene had a lower freezing point than radiator fluid.
Oh, so we could
fill our radiators with kerosene.
Yeah, oh, that's neat. Yeah, see, the engineers, yeah.
Engineers.
Oh, that's neat, yeah.
And also, our laboratory, it was a regular chem physics lab with all the goodies and things like that. We had on the loading platform, which faced out on the parking lot, there was always a 50-gallon drum of chemically pure reagent-grade alcohol. 200 proof, chemically pure.
Yeah.
Whenever we had a party or something, we'd stop by at the stock room, pick up an Erlenmeyer flask and a rubber stopper, go out and fill it up.
Come there you go, yeah.
And you'd pour it into a big jug, and somebody come and pour in an equivalent amount of apple juice or fruit juice or some more of the... It's great.
Oh, that's neat, yeah. The best that money can buy or
absolutely,
can buy.
Yeah. Chemically pure. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it costs the government.
Yeah. But it made for a good party.
And that was another interesting thing. We were building an analysis machine in the lab. And it analyzed some of the uranium based upon radiation.
Okay.
So you wanted to shield it. So the idea is to have some slabs of lead. Where the hell are you going to get slabs of lead?
Yeah.
And I grew up in the printing business. My father was in the printing business.
Oh, okay.
And I talked to the procurement guy. This is American Type Founders that makes type.
Oh, yeah.
Contact them. Maybe they can do it.
Yeah.
So he did. They could. It had a high priority. And he came and told me about it. And hey, that's great.
There you go.
And then I forgot about it. And about 2 months later, I'm sitting in the engineering office there. And this grimy-looking master sergeant with a Tommy gun hanging over his shoulder comes walking in there. He says, I got a priority shipment here. He says, are you that time the PFC bill or something like
sure.
that. I said, yeah. I said, what is it? He said, well, it's just for you. And he says, it's classified top secret, and we've been guarding it all the way in from Pennsylvania. And with the Tommy gun. And here's this flatbed truck with two or three guys sitting on top of it with submachine guns guarding this lead.
Guarding sheets of lead. Yeah.
What do you want to do with them? He says, where does it go? Mm-hmm. I didn't want to tell him, just throw it out.
Throw it out
on the ground there, and when we need it, we'll pick it up.
Right.
I said, well, okay, why don't you take it and just put it out over there, and I'll have our guards come and watch it as soon as you leave. And we signed for it, and they left.
And there it was, yeah.
And there it was for about two months.
Yeah, guarding on those sheets of lead, yeah, making sure. Oh, that's crazy. Well, I guess if you need... So you started your procuring early on.
I didn't have anything to do with that. It was just that, you know...
You happen to know...
Dawned upon me that this one Alfred worked with lead. And,
yeah, that's cool.
But I remember this guy. I mean, he was grimy and... Who knows how much sleep he had.
Right.
He's protecting that stuff. Somebody came along there and he's going to blow them over.
Right, right. Top secret materials in there. Yeah, sheets of lead. Oh, that's cool. So I mean, you know, like I picture it, you know, small, but you say, you know, you had stores, you had, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, was there, you know, what would you do for like entertainment or what was, you know, because I'm sure you couldn't go and talk shop when you got home,
well,
you know,
you didn't talk shop when you went home. You didn't even talk to your neighbors and friends because they may have worked in another
right.
plant. And I didn't really know what was going on in the other plants.
Yeah.
And I certainly didn't. I knew about Los Alamos because some of my friends got transferred over to
okay.
there. But I didn't know what they were doing there.
Right.
I certainly didn't know about Hanford at all.
Yeah.
So it was...
Yeah,
it was a need to know thing.
Right.
And one of the interesting things there was, of course, you had photo badges, and we had guards, and the guards were local,
mm-hmm.
and some of them couldn't read.
Okay.
So the badges had color stripes on them, like the military campaign ribbons.
Okay.
And if that door was painted with a yellow frame and I had a yellow stripe, I could go through it.
You could go through the yellow door. Oh, that's neat. Yeah. Huh. Make it a lot easier, I guess.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, that's cool.
There was also a story, of course, about they used to have guards on horseback going out in the boonies of where the fences were. The whole area was fenced in. About one who saw this rabbit running and pulled out his gun and shot his horse over the head.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that had to be. So, how long total, like, were you there?
About 2 years,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's got to be an interesting transition into, and then an interesting transition. Out of, like...
Well, it was quite a it was an easier transition into it because I went into a basic training center, learned how to wear a uniform,
right.
and got used to it, and got used to saying sir and all that stuff. Going out of it was very easy.
Nothing to that, huh?
I did wear my uniform when I drove across country to Boeing.
Right. So you went right into Boeing from...
Yeah, I drove Doug Crossland and I, the same mm-hmm. same office, same house, same company we were going to work for. We got discharged the same day. Yeah, so I drove up to New York to see my folks and Reggie's folks and stayed there for a couple of days, I don't know how long.
Yeah.
Then drove across... country to visit an uncle in Los Angeles,
okay.
and then up the coast of California to Seattle.
Yeah.
In Seattle, of course, we wanted to rent a place, And Reggie ended up working at Boeing also in their art department.
Oh, really? And, oh, that's cool.
And we found, Boeing found for us, a little house up on a ridge overlooking the Olympic Mountains and Puget Sound. Gorgeous, gorgeous.
Beautiful.
But stinky little house, you know, that a fellow who was in the Merchant Marine during the war had bought, and his family lived in it. And he was going, they were going up to Alaska.
Okay.
And he had a bus route there, and he'd drive out of Nome, and at the end of the bus route, he had a little gold mining thing, and he'd do placer mining.
Yeah.
And then he'd get back in and go on back into Nome, pick up all the people.
Yeah.
And about, after we had been there about, oh, I don't know, he came back and he said, we decided we like it, Alaska, we're going to stay. So I want to sell a house. He says, you're living in it. If you want to buy it, whatever I paid for it, it's yours.
Yeah.
So, how much you pay for it? $7,000. Oh, that's too much. I haven't got that kind
of
money.
Yeah, there's no way.
So we didn't. Oh, the land that that house was on today must be worth several millions of dollars.
I'm sure, yeah.
Just because it was right on a ridge with a road and then a drop-off on the other side. You couldn't build on the other side to break the view of the Olympics and Puget Sound.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. So...
So that was when you were working for Boeing.
That's when I was working for Boeing.
So where did you go after that?
Oh, well, after that, well, we decided it was time to have a child. So my wife was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that if we continued living in Seattle, which we liked,
mm-hmm.
it was gorgeous out there, we'd be trapped. Every time we had a vacation or something, we'd have to go back to Long Island, where the two sets of grandparents were, where this would be the first grandchild.
Right.
So we'd be better off going back there and leaving the grandchildren with them when we want to go on vacation and have the children grow up with grandparents nearby. So I got a job with Republic Aviation.
Okay.
They made the Thunderbolt fighters and things like that. They had a development engineering department, and they were working on a missile, a cruise missile, ramjet. And I knew all about ramjets because I'd been working on that at Boeing.
Yeah.
And I got $7 more a week. I think I was up to $67 a month.
Wow.
Week.
Yeah, yeah. Good money at the time?
Hey.
Yeah. Oh, that's
it was
neat.
Especially good money because my folks had a two-family house mm-hmm. that they rented out in the summertime, the upper floor, to summer people because we were in a beach community.
Yeah.
And then they decided it was just too damn much trouble and it wasn't worth it. So we just moved right into the upstairs apartment. I have built-in babysitters. And
that's perfect.
My three kids were all born in the Long Beach Hospital.
Yeah. Oh, that's neat. Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of us is with our family is my parent, you know, grandparents are all here. And so, you know, we would never consider going anywhere else because, you know, for the kids to be able to grow up with grandparents and things, that's pretty, pretty nice.
When I was at Republic for about, less than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost their contract.
Okay.
On this cruise missile. In fact, I told them they were going to lose the contract because they had subcontractors doing all the work.
Right.
And there was no reason why the Air Force couldn't go directly to the subcontractors. By that time, we figured, well, you know, hang around there maybe. I couldn't find any airplane jobs or anything like that. So I went into business with my father and a cousin in the printing business.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And for about 8 years.
Yeah.
We had a terrific business in New York. especially with me being an engineer and my cousin being a CPA and my father being an old printer and a super salesman. We did very, very well.
That's awesome.
Until I suddenly decided one time, by this time we had three kids and our own house, waterfront and all that.
Yeah. Right?
I don't want to be in the New York area. You know, I don't want, I hate this idea of commuting in every morning on a train and every afternoon back, taking the subway to work, fighting with my father and cousin regularly about different things.
Right.
Though we were making great money.
Right.
If I get myself a job back in the industry, take anyone, work at it for about a year, I don't care what the salary is, get my hand back in, and I move on to something else.
Yeah.
So, Douglas offered me a job in their missile and space store, and it wasn't very much.
Right.
But I figured, no big deal. And handed my share of the business over to my brother.
Yeah.
And left.
Well, yeah. And then you were back with Douglas.
And I was then I was with Douglas, not Boeing, but Douglas.
Right.
And Douglas was a fabulous outfit to work for. Old man Douglas was, he believed in his employees and he believed in turning out quality products.
Yeah.
And he didn't care who you were and what you told him, that, like Howard Hughes, he kicked him out of the plant.
Yeah.
Because Hughes insisted on, they want to buy one of your DC-6s. Okay, fine. And he said, I'll send all my inspectors over there, and the hell you will. You don't need to.
Yeah.
When I deliver something, it's good. And he said, but I'm going to send my people over. He says,
really? Raise
the door, get out, kick them out.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were great people to work for. In fact, when I went to work for them, I really was getting less than $10,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. But it was at a company that you were...
But it was a company, but it was good. I was learning a lot. Because 8 years I'd been out of the business.
Right.
And my boss called me in one day. And he says, he's interesting too. He's a West Point graduate who had been on Project Paperclip, which brought all the von Braun and the German scientists back to the United States after the war.
Okay.
He said, we've been looking at your salary, and we made a mistake. Oh, hell. He says, you're not getting paid enough.
Okay.
I said, okay. He says, I can't give you more than 10%. He says, but that's good enough for now.
Yeah. Awesome.
Just like that. And they were like that.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah, respectful if you're putting the work in. Yeah. Well, that's neat.
But it was really nice.
So how long were you with Douglas then?
I was with Douglas a total, which became McDonnell Douglas the last few years. About 17 and a half years.
Okay.
But during that time, I was offered a couple of other jobs by other companies because I had been working with them.
Right.
Like I had been working with a small rocket company out in Redlands, California.
Okay.
When we were doing this highest energy propellant and stuff. And they were having real trouble with their management. And I was out there 2-3 times a week.
Okay.
90 miles away from the Douglas plant. I ended up flying back and forth.
Yeah.
Learned how to fly.
Oh, that's cool.
Douglas airplanes.
That's cool,
And they offered me a job as the manager there. One day, I came in and had lunch with them. President was a small outfit. He says, Hal, you know we're having problems here. They say, how about you coming to work for us and get them cleaned up?
Yeah.
So I said, gee, don't know if my wife will like living out here. He said, well, come on out this weekend with her, and we'll put you up, and my wife will take her around.
Right.
And show things. Well, did that. They sent me a formal letter in the middle of the week. The day after I got the letter, I came to work, and my Douglas boss was sitting at my desk. And he said, you know, he says, you've been in this job a little bit too long. He says, how would you like to take over the advanced projects?
Yes. He didn't want you getting sharked from somebody, yeah.
He knew about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because next day, when I was by regular trip out to Redlands, went out there and the president said, go on in here, I got to talk to you.
Yeah.
He said, forget about the job offer. I said, what do you mean? He says, I was told that if we wanted to keep our contract, you had better not be on our staff.
Quit messing with you. Well, that's good to, I mean, to be, you know, seen as valuable. Well, but, that's awesome.
But I still don't know how they found out.
Right.
But they did.
There's spies everywhere, not just the Manhattan Project thing. Yeah, you know. Yeah, and, that's interesting.
Douglas had this big, well, not big, but a large area that was called Advanced Projects, and it had special groups, a propulsion group, structures group, electronics, that kind of thing.
Okay.
All within an open area so that we could talk to one another.
Yeah.
And we did all the proposals, and we did all the advanced studies. So I had the propulsion group. I had liquid rockets, solid rockets, nuclear rockets, ion rockets, nuclear power sources,
okay.
All of that.
Yeah.
Which was just fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, learned a lot, did a lot, met a lot of people.
Yeah.
That I used working for the museum.
Yeah, exactly. That were, yeah, the contacts. That's where, yeah.
And so that was fun.
So you were there for like 17 and a half years, you said?
17 and a half years.
Yeah. And okay. Then.
Amongst which was I had this advanced project thing. And then one of the guys that I knew who was the head of the structures department. Because I mean, you got to know the heads
sure.
of all the departments because they were in there for whenever we have our design sessions.
Right.
He became, he became a field station manager at White Sands.
Okay.
So I got to know him when I was at Point Magoo. We were back and forth because every time they had a launch, we sent our test conductor down there to back up their guy.
Okay.
Every time I had a launch, they sent their test conductor back up. Of course, I was the test conductor for about 10 launches.
Okay.
That was my first one up there.
That's so cool.
And so Steve got me into a lot of things. He came back to the plant, and he became the director of launch vehicles, for instance. And I was doing something else. He called me up one day, and he says, come on over to my office. He said, I got a new office. He said, come on over here.
Yeah.
Have a cup of coffee. Okay, come over there. And he's nice big office and talking to Alan. And he said, I need some help. I said, oh?
Yeah.
What are you doing? He says, go look at the sign outside the door.
Yeah.
And I said, Thurman Stevens, Director of Launch Vehicles. He says, I am, by God, the Director of Launch Vehicles.
Yeah.
And I'm having a problem.
Yeah.
I said, what's your problem? He says, well, I got this, I was telling you about this. I got this Air Force contract, and I got this NASA contract. He says, the Air Force contract's doing okay. He says, but the NASA contract, he says, those guys keep forgetting who they're working for. He says, NASA wants something extra, they do it. Right. NASA doesn't want something, they don't do it. They never look at the contract to see what we're supposed to do or what we're supposed to deliver or anything.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to get them under control. I suppose, don't look at me. I'm not a paper pusher.
Right, right.
And he said, I'm looking at you because I know you. I said, yeah. And he says, and if anybody knows how to get around the system here, he says, you do.
Right.
And therefore, you'd be a great guy to get them under control.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And he said, I'll tell you what. He says, you get them under control inside of a year, and I'll get you any job you want in the plant.
Nice.
So I said, well, let me think about it. Mm-hmm. And while I was sitting there, I'm looking out the door, and Douglas had what they called the bull gang, a bunch of great, big, hulking, heavy guys that move furniture
okay. And
things like that. And the bull gang walking by. I said, gee, you know, it looks like my desk. He says, yeah, they're putting it in the next office over here. I've already arranged your transfer.
The decision had been made, yeah. That's cool.
So I ended up being the branch chief of, I forget what it was, plans and documentation or something.
Oh, that's cool.
And he also told me one thing. He says, you're never going to get a promotion, especially if I have anything to do with it. If you don't have somebody that can step right into your job, but step right in without...
Right, having a train and all these things.
Anything. Well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
I was in that job for about, I don't know, a year. When I got into this launch field, this launching genus and such. I used to go into, he got to work every morning. He's vice president. He got to work every morning very early.
Okay.
And I got to work very early because I would be talking to people across in the New York area, in the Washington area.
Right.
And so that way nobody bothered me. I'd be on the phone and talk to them. I get it, and he had a coffee pot because he was the vice president. And therefore, every morning, the cafeteria people came in and filled a big coffee pot.
Yes.
And therefore, every morning, when I came to work, I came in with an empty cup and filled my cup and drank his coffee. And we'd sit down and talk for a little bit.
Sure.
And so I walk in there one morning, and he's on the phone, and he's holding it out at arm's length, and you hear this loud voice screaming and shouting. And every once in a while, he prayed up his head and said, yes, Ray. And turned out that it was the Air Force colonel that was running this Air Force Thorogena launch program out of Vandenberg.
Okay.
And he was screaming because of the Douglas guy that was running the Douglas side of it. Get that goddamn guy off my program. I don't ever want to see him again. I'm getting sick and tired of him telling me what I have to do and what I don't have to do. And get him the hell off the thing. He said, if I ever see him in the plant when I come in there, I'm going to cancel your contract. If I ever hear that he's charged anything of mine, I'm going to cancel your contract. I don't want to ever see him.
Right.
So I start walking out of there.
Right, sneaking out.
And he said, right back. So I came back and he picked up the phone. He says, Ray, how about Hal Bell? He says, tell him to get his ass over here. Right now, we got to talk. And I did that program for about 3 years.
Oh, that's cool. That's how you got thrown into that one.
Yeah, but I used to go up to Vandenberg and I'd stay at his house instead of a hotel.
Right. That's cool. That would work.
I mean, we were very good friends.
Yeah. Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
But it was, get him the hell over here right now.
So you were in high demand. I mean, yeah, they would.
Well, it was kind of fun. You know the right people, and you mostly if you're in the right place at the right time, it works out.
Yep.
And that's my theory. If you're in the right place at the right time and can take advantage of it,
right?
Like I had never gotten that launch vehicle job if I wasn't stealing coffee every morning.
Right. See, and they say coffee's not good for you. I don't know. It seems like it works.
And
Oh, that's neat.
And if I, you know, hadn't been at Point Magoo test conducting and stuff, and this guy hadn't been at White Sands, mm-hmm. again,
right
I wouldn't have known him.
Yeah, right place, right time. Well, and doing a lot of work and you know, working to put yourself in a good position where you are something valuable.
People know you, and, mm-hmm. but I don't know if he'd have thought of me for that lunch thing if I wasn't sitting right there listening to him.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. So you moved in, so you're now taking care of business for them. How long were you doing that, or what were you doing there?
What?
When you went over that he had to have you take care of
I took care of the launch program.
Yeah.
I managed the whole thing. I wrote the proposals. We negotiated every year. I negotiated it. I wrote the proposals. I was at Vandenberg. I would say at least twice a week.
Yeah.
Up there, and I was twice a week. I was down at the Air Force Space Division. I had stickers on my car for Vandenberg, for Douglas, for Space Division.
Right.
And badges.
Yeah.
See little badges over there?
Oh, that's cool. So these are the connections, though, I mean, that ended up benefiting the museum. Yeah. You know,
it also gives you a little more confidence.
Yeah.
that the guys on the other side of the big fancy desks aren't... They're not absolutely great and
right.
unapproachable.
Yeah. Just got to be willing to do it.
On my first job, when I was at Confair in San Diego, we were working, this was wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working 5 10-hour days and 8 hours on Saturday. We had Sundays off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten among other reasons, was because of that naval aircraft factory thing. I had gotten the highest salary that anybody in my class was offered when we graduated.
Yeah.
It's $1.05 an hour. Yeah. So that there was, you know, like 20 hours of overtime.
Right, yeah.
At time and a half. So that really...
Yeah, that's getting that up really to all, yeah, almost
$2. But anyways, one day, we had some drawings. I was in the wing and tail group. So the airplane pictures up there with the big tail?
Mm-hmm.
I designed it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
the
B-32 cool.
Bomber.
Yeah.
Anyways, so we had some drawings that had to come out, get out for the shop on Monday morning. And so my friendly boss said, hey, anybody volunteer to come in and do the paperwork and stuff? I wasn't married. Used to do a lot of hiking and such, but I didn't have anything for that day. And besides that, it was double time.
Oh, so that's even better.
$2.10 an hour, you know. And so I said, okay, I'll come in.
Yeah.
And I had an uncle who lived in Los Angeles area. That's, you know, just north of San Diego.
Sure.
And his wife was a lovely person, but the world's lousiest cook. She was just awful.
Yeah.
But she could make great peanut butter cookies.
There you go.
So about once a month, I would take the bus up and go visit them. And she'd give me a big jar of peanut butter cookies to take back. So I went to work on the Sunday morning, and I had my big jar of peanut butter cookies because the cafeteria obviously wasn't open and
right.
all that. And this huge engineering department with hundreds of desks was dead empty.
Right.
And I was the only one there,
yeah.
you know. So I was working, and all of a sudden eating peanut butter cookies. Working there, and all of a sudden I look around. There's this little ratty-looking fellow. You know, ratty looking clothes and such. Anyways, he's, what are you doing? So I told him, you know, words of one syllable and explaining
right.
where this went into that and you want some cookies, you know.
Yeah.
He's eating cookies and I was eating them. We were talking for about an hour or so. And just ended up talking about everything. You know, like right. Do you like your job? Do you,
sure.
You know, where are you living? And and all that. And with peanut butter cookies were gone, he disappeared. So anyways, I finished the job. Came in the next morning. My boss came running over to me. Chief engineer wants to see you right now. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Where's his office?
Right.
He said, I don't know, it's over there somewhere. You know, I said, well, what's his name? He said, I don't really know. He said, I've never met him. Okay, so I wandered off and I finally asked enough questions. Yeah. I finally got into the second secretary's office, said, I think the chief engineer wants to see me. What's your name? Yeah, okay, go on in. The next secretary, oh yeah, you go right in. He has this huge office. A big desk. Who's sitting behind the desk? My little janitor.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, okay. He said, you know, we were talking yesterday. He said, I asked you if you liked your job. And you said, yeah, you do like it, but you wish you were not just working on a specific part of the airplane, the whole airplane. He said, I got a job for you.
Really? See, it pays to be nice, no matter who the person is.
So that's neat.
Yeah.
Then about 6 months later, when I knew that I would have to go into service, and I knew I was going to go back east to get married,
mm-hmm.
and then go into the service, in those days, in wartime, you didn't travel without priorities on trains or airplanes.
Okay.
And if you want to travel by train, and you could, you bought a ticket, like from San Diego to New York, and you got on the first train that went through that was going east, and you stayed on it, even if you slept on the floor,
right.
You stayed on it until it turned off to go somewhere else,
right.
And then you got off and waited for the next one. So, anyways, I decided I'm going to leave, and I went into this guy's office to say, thanks for all everything you've done
right.
for me. And I told him I was leaving and getting married and all
mm-hmm.
that. And he says, how are you getting back? So I told him, I said, down railroad station and climb on the first train going east.
Right.
He says, no, you're not. I said, what do you mean? He says, I've got an airplane coming out of off the line here every hour. We have to deliver them.
Oh, wow.
He says, tell you what you do. He says, you sign out, check out, and when you're checking out and they ask you for your badge, say you lost it.
Okay.
And then come in Monday morning, which is 2 days or 3 days later, and go right down the flight line. He says, they'll be waiting for you. So I flew home.
Really? Oh, that's neat. That is neat. Yeah, and it's all because you were nice to a guy that...
No, it's also because he was a pretty sharp guy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that is neat.
And nobody said he had to be in on Sunday.
Right.
Running around.
Yeah. That is neat. Yeah, that's a good story, like, in and of itself.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And that was your start on designing, working on the bigger project on the
uh-huh.
planes and things?
Yeah.
Huh. Just because of peanut butter cookies.
Just peanut butter cookies. So that's what he did.
Thank you so much, Hal, for giving us this wonderful opportunity to listen to some of your stories and get some insight into how the museum got some of our most important objects. We really appreciate you sitting down with David and taking the time to talk to us about your extremely exciting and interesting life. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, it was wonderful, Hal. We really appreciate you, you know, just inviting us into your house and you know, like she says, chatting with you.
Yeah.
And so that was our Hal interview, you know, and that kind of wraps that up. What are we looking at for 2021?
See, that is a good question, David. I had heard a potential idea for our next interview series, a contact with the Tularosa Downwinders. And that there's a representative who might be willing to talk to us. So that's in the planning stages. That might be something. Yeah, it's a really complicated story that I'm definitely going to leave to a full episode to explain. But I think that that's going to be a really interesting interview. I think we've also got some more observer effects. I've been accessioning and cataloging a whole bunch of new items into our collections, and we've got some cool stuff. We've got some weird stuff. Yeah, I think it'll be really fun to maybe learn about irradiated pet milk. That's the thing we've got a can of. You want to learn more? Right. I want to learn more.
There you go. Definitely. Yeah.
I think we got a whole new thing about nuclear submarines. We also would love to hear about what our audience wants to listen to. What do you want to know more about? We did a safety series. Would you like us to do a power plant series? Or, again, we got a bunch on subs. Do you want to learn how nuclear subs work? What is it that you would like to hear from us? If you have any ideas or suggestions, please feel free to email us at info@nuclearmuseum.org. That's info@nuclearmuseum.org.
Awesome. Well, I do appreciate you, you know, especially with those observer series, you know, finding all that information and making some fun stuff. I always enjoy learning about them and you know, hearing the craziness that we as humans have brought in the past and maybe we'll bring a little bit of that craziness into 2021.
I think it should be great. And, you know, we can't end our podcast without saying our greatest thanks to our Atomic History patron members.
Definitely.
You've made this podcast possible, and we're roaring into 2021 with your guys' help and continued support. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much. And of course, as we end everything, we will continue on in 2021 with reminding everyone to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.